Good morning again, everybody. Thanks once again to Ann Laura for her Dharma talk last night. That is such a great idea. It never occurred to me to collect Dharma metaphors. Isn't that a good idea? It's a profound idea. I hope Ann Laura will keep it up and report to us from time to time on different Dharma metaphors that she's located. I think it was yesterday that I brought up the story of Nanyue polishing a tile, and I gave you Dogen's very unusual interpretation of this story. And I'm sure you've heard me say many times that Dogen always does this. He turns the Zen stories upside down so that the person in the story who clearly appears to be clueless is actually awakened. And their apparently clueless responses in the story turn out to be enlightened responses in Dogen's reading. That's kind of what he does all the time. And why does he do that? Does he just want to be provocative, you know, and tweak all the other Zen masters, maybe? But if you think about it, you realize that what he's actually doing here is he's enacting, through these very clever and offbeat takes, the fact that, and I mentioned it yesterday, he says it directly in his commentary yesterday, there's always another way to look at things. Don't think there's just one way to look at things. But more than that, if you want to have a generous spirit and a generous mind, it's always possible to look at things with sympathy. Not just look to see who's right and who's wrong, who wins and who loses, but instead to have a view that sees everything that's happening as unfolding in the light of awakening. And that's the way Dogen is reading these stories. Now, I can easily imagine a way of doing Zen that upheld the Zen stories in the usual way. A typical story, say, involving an unenlightened student who asks a question and is straightened out by and put down by the enlightened Zen master. And then the Zen Sangha practices like that. And everybody is going around scared to say anything or do anything that it might be look like an unenlightened thing to say or do. And the teacher is looking around at everyone, you know, with a fish eye, and everybody's like withering under the fish eye. And everybody is striving mightily to be right and not wrong, enlightened and not unenlightened, and no one is ever succeeding at this. Remind me not to go practice at that Zen center. Probably there aren't any Zen centers like that, at least I hope there aren't. But you could see why there might be, because if you took the Zen stories, you know, at their face value, that you could end up with some kind of attitude like that. Dharma combat, which is what they call question and answer ceremonies in Zen. Dharma combat, a battle of the wits, a competitive sport. But we follow Dogen's interpretation, and we don't view it that way. For Dogen, all the people in the stories as a collective are enlightenment. The whole of it is enlightenment. And they all bring up the truth together. Now, we know from reading Dogen that he certainly understands that there are wrong views and right views. He doesn't think it's Dharma is what anybody says it is. But he thinks that the true teaching includes both right and wrong views, and that the whole of the assembly including all of its views, is what is the awakened mind. So when he interprets a story, he wants to show us a generous way of responding to conditions, of responding to our life. He thinks that Zen is completely and radically inclusive, not exclusive, promoting always compassion and respect, not arrogance and scorn. So maybe there are no Zen centers like that, but I think the world is kind of like that. Maybe we go forth into the world and we are taught to scan the horizon for the good guys and the bad guys. We know right away the people we approve of and the people we do not want to be associated with. The people that we know we can defeat and the other people that we know we have to be very careful around lest they defeat us. So we respect some and we scorn others. We look around and we see all sorts of bad behavior and incompetence, and we have contempt for it. So we're always on guard. Always need to make sure that we are someone who is acceptable, someone who will not be scorned or viewed as incompetent. And then we internalize this way of being in the world so completely that we actually think that that self is our self, and that's who we become. And this is really common. I think you can all relate to it. But you can't be that person too easily in Zazen. Zazen is a kind of great undoing of that person. In Zazen, there's no fooling anyone. There's no fooling yourself. Suzuki Roshi once said that when everyone, he would see people, you know, out on the street in their various fashion statements, he had a hard time telling one from the other, you know, all Westerners look alike. But when they came into the Zendo, he said, all wearing the same clothes and walking, sitting, and standing in the same way at the same time, then he could see them. He could see who they really were. And this really seems true. In Sesshin, each and every person expresses themselves clearly and perfectly. Because we can no longer keep up the effort of trying so hard to be ourselves, we can finally just be ourselves. And it's very hard to have pretenses on the cushion. They are literally too painful. There's no choice but to be what we are, messy as this may sometimes be. And as we learned yesterday from Suzuki Roshi, when you become you, the truth becomes the truth. And you can finally have a little peace and a true basis for confidence. So I think Dogen's way of interpreting Zen stories is a great way to live. Seeing things as they actually are, the good as good, the bad as bad, but seeing all of it as the unfolding of enlightenment. So we don't have to complain about anyone, or about ourselves, or about the world. We can see, yes, this is good, this is beautiful, this is inspiring, this is absolutely terrible. This is a big mistake. This is really stupid and destructive behavior. But also, this is how it is. It's just like that. It is not some other way. And the way forward is always from here. Because this is where and who we are, not someone else, not somewhere else. There is no other way forward but from here. To think it should be different, I should be different, he should be different, she should be different, they should be different, it's just a waste of time. So that's how to be generous in your life, letting things be as they are, and then responding with strength and integrity to conditions as we find them. In Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi speaks about Dana Paramita, the practice of generosity. And this, I think, is a very famous passage in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, in which Suzuki Roshi, maybe surprisingly, uses the word God. It's the sort of basis of what he's saying here. God as creator. You might not think that a Zen master would talk about God. Seems odd, you know. But actually, I think it's pretty much the truth that all 20th century Japanese Zen masters were very aware of Christianity. Most of them studied Christianity in the Buddhist universities that they attended. And they had a respect for it, and they felt like Buddhism could learn from it. Don't forget, you know, since the Meiji Restoration, Japanese were obsessed with Western ideologies and Western understanding. They were trying to learn about the West. So anybody born after, you know, 1868, basically, in Japan, was aware of the West, and Suzuki Roshi certainly was. It's Western Buddhist teachers, not Japanese or Asian Buddhist teachers. Western Buddhist teachers are much more likely to be offended by the idea of God and to tell you that Buddhism doesn't believe in God, there's no idea of God in Buddhism, which is the truth. But in this passage, Suzuki Roshi seems to be on very good terms with God. So this is what he says. According to Christianity, every existence in nature is something which was created for or given to us by God. That is the perfect idea of giving. But if you think that God created people and that you are somehow separate from God, you are liable to think you have the ability to create something separate, something not given by God. For instance, we create airplanes and highways. God would never do such a thing as that, you know. Well, we did that. And when we repeat, I create, I create, I create, soon we forget who is actually the I which creates the various things. In other words, we soon forget about God. And this is the danger of human culture. Actually, to create with the big I is to give. We cannot create and own what we create for ourselves, since everything was created by God. This point should not be forgotten. But because we do forget who is doing the creating and the reason for the creation, we become attached to the material or exchange value, which has no value in comparison to the absolute value of something as God's creation. Even if something has no material or relative value to any small I, it has absolute value in itself. Not to be attached to something is to be aware of its absolute value. Everything you do should be based on such an awareness and not on material or self-centered ideas of value. Then whatever you do is true giving, it's dana. Prajna, paramita. When we sit in cross-legged posture, we resume our fundamental activity of creation. There are perhaps three kinds of creation. The first is to be aware of ourselves after we finish doing zazen. That's the first kind of creation. When we sit, we're nothing. We don't even realize what we are. We just sit. But when we stand up, there we are. That's the first step in creation. And when you're there, everything else is there. Everything is created all at once. When we emerge from nothing, when everything emerges from nothing, we see it all as a fresh new creation. This is non-attachment. The second kind of creation is when you act or produce or prepare something like food or tea. The third kind is to create something within yourself, such as education or culture or art or some system for our society. So there are three kinds of creation. But if you forget the first, the most important one, the other two will be like children who have lost their parents. Their creation will mean nothing. Usually everyone forgets about zazen. Everyone forgets about God. They work very hard at the second or third kinds of creation, but God does not help the activity. How is it possible for God to help when God doesn't realize who God is? That's why we have so many problems in the world. When we forget the fundamental source of our creating, we are like children who do not know what to do when they lose their parents. If you understand Dana Prajnaparamita, you will understand how it is we create so many problems for ourselves. Of course, to live is to create problems. If we did not appear in the world, our parents would have no difficulty with us. Just by appearing, we create problems for them, which Anler quoted, I think, in her talk, that last part. And you can appreciate if you have children, you know what he means. Our children are wonderful, we love them. But with their existence, we have a whole new set of problems we never would have dreamed of having. It's sort of interesting to think of the whole world as full of people who are like children who lost their parents, you know, and don't know what to do. It sort of makes sense. So, the other day I told you the story, or at least part of the story, of the ever-weeping Bodhisattva Sataparudita. And I felt a little bad about it, you know, because I left it off in the middle. And I said, and everything worked out okay, and I left it at that. So I did look it up, and I'll tell you the rest of the story. It's more complicated than I'm going to tell you, because it goes on for many, many pages, but I'm simplifying it. So you recall that Sataparudita was in the marketplace trying to sell his body so that he could raise some funds to make an offering to the teacher, Dharmadgatra, who was the teacher that he knew could teach him Prajnaparamita. So there he was in the marketplace. Anybody want a body? Anybody need a heart or an arm or a leg? Please, anybody? And what he didn't know is that Mara, the evil one, who really hates it when somebody tries to practice sincerely and makes all kinds of trouble for them, Mara didn't like it that he was so sincere and so pure, so he caused everyone in the marketplace to ignore him, and nobody would buy any part of his body. He couldn't, and he was really upset about that, and he began to weep all over again. There he was in the marketplace, nobody would respond to him. So at that point, Chakra, the king of the gods, got involved, and wanted to test Sataparuta's determination. So he appeared to see if, you know, Sataparuta really would sell his body. So he appeared as a young man who said, yes, I would like to buy your body. We have to do a sacrifice at our house, and we need body parts, you know, for a sacrifice. So Sataparuta was very excited about this and said, oh boy, that's great, that's great. And he got out a big dagger and started cutting himself up and bleeding and everything. Very enthusiastic about all this. Meanwhile, from a window above the marketplace, a merchant's daughter was watching this whole thing, and she was appalled by this. She thought, this is terrible. So she went running downstairs and said, you know, don't do this. And she, of course, said, I don't want to buy any of your body parts, but I will give you all the money you could possibly need to make a donation to this bodhisattva that you want to go visit. And not only that, I'll go with you. Not only will I go with you, my whole family's going to go with you, and 500 servants. We're all going to go with you to see this bodhisattva. And so when all that happened, Chakra, the king of the gods, was impressed and immediately restored Sataparuta's body to its wholeness. And off they went, because now they knew where and how far. So they arrived there eventually at the city where this bodhisattva lives. And they find that he has written down the Prajnaparamita teachings on scrolls, and sealed the scrolls with gold, and enshrined the scrolls on a high tower. So they went and they made offerings to the tower, and they worshiped the tower, and they did prostrations, and they requested the teachings. And finally, Dharmagatra comes out and gives a teaching about how the Buddhas never come or go, because suchness neither comes nor goes, and all dharmas are unproduced. That's the gist of what he says. Of course, he says it at great length. I'm not going to repeat it for you, but that's the gist of what he says. And at that point, there's a tremendous earthquake. And the earth shakes in six different ways. And Sataparuta says, whoa, what happened there? How come that happened? And the bodhisattva says, that happened because when I just gave those teachings, countless bodhisattvas all over the place achieved perfection. And that's what caused that giant earthquake. And hearing this, Sataparuta becomes overwhelmed with joy and zest. So much so that he rises from the air, 7 palm trees high. And while he's up there, Chakra says, would you like some Mandarava flowers that you could rain down right now on Dharmagotra from up here? And he gives him the flowers and he rains them down on the bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva Dharmagotra accepts these wonderful gifts, and this inspires him to turn around and go inside his hermitage, where he goes into retreat for 7 years, during which he's continuously in one samadhi for 7 years. So Sataparuta doesn't quite know what to do, and he decides that he's going to just practice sitting and walking and nothing else until Dharmagotra comes out from retreat. So for 7 years, he sits, he walks and sits, and he doesn't lie down. 7 years goes by, and he hears a voice from the sky saying, the Bodhisattva Dharmagotra is about to emerge from the retreat and teach the holy Prajnaparamita teachings. Whoa, you can imagine the excitement that Sataparuta, after all this, right? Now it's going to happen, finally. He's really, really excited. And the merchant's daughter is excited, and the merchant's excited, and 500 servants are all excited, and they all prepare, you know, they got to go to many, many things to prepare the space, you know, for the teachings that are about to happen. And finally, Dharmagotra emerges from his hermitage, sits down on the seat, prepared, and there are hundreds of thousands of bodhisattvas in attendance. And then the text says, he then demonstrated the Dharma. And I will now quote directly from the sutra. And this is the demonstration of the perfection of wisdom by the Bodhisattva of wisdom, Dharmagotra. This is what he says. The perfection of wisdom is self-identical because all dharmas are the same. The perfection of wisdom is isolated because all dharmas are isolated. The perfection of wisdom is immobile because all dharmas are immobile. Perfect wisdom is devoid of mental acts because all dharmas are devoid of mental acts. Perfect wisdom is unbenumbed, don't ask, unbenumbed, because all dharmas are unbenumbed. Perfect wisdom has but one single taste because all dharmas have one and the same taste. Perfect wisdom is boundless because all dharmas are boundless. Perfect wisdom is non-production because all dharmas are non-production. Perfect wisdom is non-stopping because all dharmas are not stopped. As the firmament is boundless, so is perfect wisdom. As the ocean is boundless, and there's Anlor's ocean. As the ocean is boundless, so is perfect wisdom. As Meru, great Mount Meru, shines in multicolored brilliance, so does the perfection of wisdom. As the firmament is not fashioned, so is perfect wisdom not fashioned. Perfect wisdom is boundless because form and the other skandhas are boundless. Perfect wisdom is boundless because the element of earth and the other elements are boundless. Perfect wisdom is self-identical because of the adamantine dharma is self-identical. Perfect wisdom is undifferentiated because all dharmas are undifferentiated. And it goes on like that for quite a while. Well, hearing this teaching, Sataparudra is even more overcome with joy. And he promptly enters into 6 million concentration states, many of which are named over a variety of pages, many pages. And then after that's all described, it says the following. This is now a quotation from the sutra. In conjunction with the acquisition of the 6 million concentration doors, the Bodhisattva Sataparudra saw the Buddhas and the Lords in all the 10 directions in countless tri-chiliocosms. So all the universes that the astronomers and everybody know about, he saw all that, and he saw that all of them were nothing but little Buddhas everywhere. Everyone, each one, surrounded by a whole congregation of monks, accompanied by multitudes of bodhisattvas, and each one, in all of this everywhere, was teaching exactly these words of the Prajnaparamita, using exactly these methods. Same words, same letters, even as you are now reading this Prajnaparamita text, same. Surrounded by congregations of practitioners, multitudes of bodhisattvas, and teaching just this perfection of wisdom through just these methods and just these words, it does repeat, as I'm repeating, in just these letters. Sataparudra became endowed with inconceivable learning and a sacred knowledge, vast as the ocean. And in his subsequent births, he was never again deprived of connection to the Buddha. He was reborn only where he could be face to face with Buddhas. He had abandoned all unfortunate rebirths and had secured the circumstances which allowed him to accomplish one auspicious rebirth after another. And that's more or less what happens to Sataparudra in the sutra. A little bit more, but that's pretty much the end of the sutra. I feel better now. So now, to bring us back down to earth, I will quote again from our teacher, Dzogchen Roshi, in his great book, Seeing One Thing Through. if you hear stories like the story of Sataprutada, which is not an atypical story from the Mahayana Sutras, and it makes you wonder, what am I supposed to make of that? Where is that coming from? I mean, here I am on Earth, you know, what am I supposed to do with that? This is the answer. So this is from a little section called Gyoji and Dokkan. Gyoji and Dokkan are two terms in Soto Zen that we should be familiar with. Gyoji is a term that Dogen used that means continuous practice. And Dokkan means way, ring, the cyclical daily form of practice. Without using this Japanese nomenclature, Gyoji, Doki, Dokkan, was the fundamental practice that Suzuki Roshi introduced to us. In a talk, Suzuki Roshi said, if you lose the spirit of repetition, your practice will become quite difficult. He also said that if you chant the Heart Sutra once, you may feel okay about it, but if you chant it over and over every day, you might lose your original attitude toward it. You might maintain your beginner's mind for a few years, but after a while, you are liable to lose the limitless meaning of original mind. This presents an interesting koan for us. In an unrepeatable universe, how can any act be repeated? The only way is to be fully present in each moment and each activity as just this, just now, without comparing. I remember observing my teacher's behavior. Nothing special. Living each moment with total presence, not getting ahead, not lagging behind. Suzuki Roshi sat Zazen every morning and every evening, bowed 9 times, and chanted the Heart Sutra 3 times, which was our original service. Just repeating the Heart Sutra 3 times. In between, he simply responded to circumstances with the same attitude. His life was all of a piece. He did not have a lot of dependencies. His demeanor was relaxed, soft, flexible, and upright. He was always shining, and his presence was nourishing. That's a beautiful thought, isn't it? Dokkan, the ring or circle of the way, is the non-repeatable rhythm of daily practice. It is to follow the cosmic order. Every day the sun appears in the sky, and at night the moon, while the planets circle in their orbits. At night the world sleeps, and at dawn we awake. This is the basic cycle, the formal alternation we call night and day. It is the turning of the world in harmony with the cosmos. All creatures follow individual and collective patterns and the various formalities and structures that support our unique situation. The life of a Zen student revolves around Zazen, while Zazen opens us up to the cosmic order. Do, or Dao, the Do of Dokkan, means the path or the way, and the Kan means ring or circle, the cycle of practice, doing something over and over again. When sitting, we hold our hands in the cosmic mudra, which is really important, that mudra. The form of the hands creates the empty circle that creates the form of the hands. All is empty, and empty is all. Although there are many things that are important in our lives, receiving our nourishment from the source has to be primary. When we survey the cosmos, we see an infinite variety of circular forms. We experience the cycle of the seasons and the cycles within the cycles within the cycles, and we realize that each one of us is the place where heaven and earth meet. We can also see that circles of energy emanate from us and mix and overlap with those of others. Ooh. If I sneeze, it would blast everybody out of the room. I better not sneeze.
We can rain down and water all the
flowers. Yeah, flowers, flowers. The way we think and act has an effect. To sit upright in the center of the empty circle as a vehicle for light is the Zen student's life. That's pretty good. I'll say that again. To sit upright in the center of the empty circle as a vehicle for light is the Zen student's life. The cycle of continuous practice of sitting Zazen and allowing that selfless freedom to be expressed in daily life is the turning of the wheel and the basis for harmony. It's a wonderful passage. I remember the first time I visited Tassajara a long time ago. I had that feeling. I had the feeling that the sound of the bell and the daily round of Zen practice was the human answer to the daily round of the sun coming up and the sun going down, and all the animals knowing exactly what they had to do and doing it in their own way, the way people would do it, is like this, with the bell, and the walking to the Zendo, and the leaving the Zendo, and the going to bed, and the waking up. But speaking of the cosmos and the cosmic cycles, you all know there's an eclipse coming soon, day after tomorrow, I think. And Kathy and I are going to see this eclipse. And so we're going to leave the session at breakfast. We'll go to breakfast and say goodbye at breakfast. And so I apologize that we're leaving early. It's funny, the newspapers are saying that this big, long path of the, where the eclipse can be seen is mostly cloud covered in the United States. So maybe we and 2 or 3 million other people who are going to great lengths to see the eclipse will see maybe some sort of odd darkness during the day, and that is all. So it will be a Soto Zen eclipse. No, thank you. It'll be a Soto Zen eclipse, you know, practice but no enlightenment. Not even enlightenment. Darkenment. Yeah. Or maybe not. Maybe we'll be lucky and we'll see something. I don't know. I think one time Kathy and I went to see Mount Fuji, and the same thing. We saw fog. No Mount Fuji. And we used to go in the Rohatsu Sesshin at Green Gulch long ago. I would take people out in the morning to see the morning star, you know. And we'd go out to the fields to see the morning star, and invariably it would be totally foggy and there were no stars. So that was my last Dharma talk for the session. So I want to thank all of you again for being here, for sitting, for listening to my talks, for your practice. I want to thank Ann Luhr for her talks and her steady and inspiring presence. And I want to thank Greg and Shofi for helping her in this session and throughout the practice period. And Steve for doing the same for me. I want to thank our Enos, who have been really great, keeping us on the beam, making the session so strong. And the Doan Ryo for their work. And Marianne for being such a great trainer of Doans. And all the priests for officiating at the services, the senior teachers for offering practice discussion. I hope some of you have had a few minutes to do Zazen and in between your various discussions with all of our practice leaders. Also, I want to now mention and thank everybody online. I know there's been a core of people who have been very faithfully attending every period of zazen at home. And although my mind has been here at Santa Sabina and with all of us sitting here together, I have been aware of everybody supporting us online, and I feel that support. And thanks to John and Jane and the others who have made the online, Laura and the others who have made the online session possible. What an effort by so many people. That's what makes this experience possible. And our practice period that has been so terrific and inspiring is also going to close pretty soon. We'll have our daily zazen practice period, daily zazen schedule through the week. On Wednesday, we'll have our final seminar on Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind at the usual time. It'll be online only. And this is important. You've heard me yak so much that enough is enough. So on Wednesday, I think that I won't give a talk, but everybody come and bring your favorite passage from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and we'll read passages to one another and comment on them, kind of like what Ann-Laura is doing in her talk, reading a passage and saying a few things. So let's all come ready to share that way. And then on Friday morning, we will practice our new practice that we started last year. You know, every year I read you the, not every year, but a lot of times I read Dogen's fascicle on practice period, where he tells the story of Manjushri, who shows up on the last day of practice period when they're in the middle of a pravarana ceremony. And I read that all the time, and I thought, how come nobody ever does the pravarana ceremony? So last year, we figured out how to do the pravarana ceremony, and we did it last year online. And we're going to do hopefully this can be an annual practice for us. It's a kind of a confession ceremony where everybody gets together and says to one another, I totally failed in the practice period. And the other one says, yeah, me too. And that's what we do in that ceremony. So we'll practice that on Friday. And then on Saturday, that'll be our big day, a week from today, Shusoho Senshiki, Buddha's birthday, and closing the practice period all in one big ceremony. And this is really wonderful, especially the Shusoho Senshiki, the Shuso question and response ceremony, which is really going to be great this year. We can hardly wait to hear what Ann-Laura, how she's going to respond to all of us. So these are wonderful ceremonies, all of them. And I hope that all of you will be able to attend, if you can attend on Saturday at the church in person, that will be great. So we are in the last part of our session, and this is the most precious part. After great effort, you have calmed your mind and settled your heart. And now you can have a time when really and truly you'll be able to understand your life more deeply than you ever have before, and let that understanding settle into your bones so that it becomes real for you and indelible. So stay with it. This is the most important time to stay with it. Don't get distracted. Don't be thinking about what you're going to do tomorrow and what you have to pack and where you're going and all that. Don't do that. Just practice here and now. Practice as if the session has not begun, never will begin, and never will end. Thank you all very much.